From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
First of all, I want to say that it is food, but it's just food wrapped in so many layers of theater and scenography and storytelling, and it's just an explosion for the senses, which can actually be quite tiring. I've always gone straight to bed after going there. And I remember we tried to take to kind of deflate that feeling of inadequateness by sitting down, and then my sister's boyfriend said nervously, I bet that the first course is like the flowers decorating the table, and we all kind of laughed, and 30 seconds later we had a waiter coming over saying, good evening and welcome to Noma, your first course is in front of you.
Noma. It's been voted best restaurant in the world 4 times in the last 5 years. Diners around the world make pilgrimages there, planning a trip to Copenhagen around a single dinner or lunch reservation. But what about locals? Are the passionate eaters of Copenhagen as enthusiastic about Noma as foodies everywhere else seem to be? Danish radio producer Christine Runo set out to find the answer.
When I was a kid, Denmark's biggest cultural export was aqua. You know, the band with the Barbie Girl hit? But in the recent years, Denmark has become known as the birthplace of another internationally acclaimed phenomenon, Noma and the idea of the so-called New Nordic. Noma is a Danish restaurant that has been awarded the best in the world 4 times. And the New Nordic is, well, until 3 weeks ago, I didn't even really know what the New Nordic was. I'd heard the term used before as something to describe a certain cultural tendency or a Scandinavian trademark of minimalistic food and design, but it turns out that the New Nordic is actually a concept invented at a symposium in Copenhagen exactly 10 years ago. Chefs and scientists and politicians from all over Scandinavia sat down for 2 days and wrote a manifesto for the New Nordic kitchen.
We felt that our own food culture sucked. And we felt that we could do better than that.
This is Klaus Meyer, a Danish chef and one of the major forces behind the symposium. He also participated in starting Noma, which embodies the ethics of the manifesto.
And maybe something that makes the New Nordic cuisine stand out compared to anything else is that we chose to let it be vegetable-based. We felt the time had come for vegetables to be the single group of ingredients shining on the plate.
Klaus explains to me that one of the first doctrines in the manifesto is simplicity. This was a response to the success of the modernist cuisine of Spain.
And this cuisine was defined by an endless search for more complicated ways to create a nice taste. So instead of serving a wonderful plate of fantastic strawberries, they would reinvent the strawberry and serve it in like, you know, a gel with a foam and something in the middle that melts. And we felt that in a time where many people are afraid that Mother Earth is collapsing, then time is not to, you know, reinvent the strawberry. Time is to try to pick the best strawberry you can and making the strawberries shine as long as we have them.
As a Dane, I suppose I should be proud that Noma and the New Nordic Manifesto has put Denmark on the map. But I haven't even been to Noma myself. Actually, I feel rather skeptical towards Noma. They're known to serve pretty odd things, like live ants. To me, it sounds kind of elitist in a dumb way. If you paid that much to eat live ants, you better tell all your friends you loved it, right? So, is Noma pure pretentious craziness, or is there something more to it? I asked my friends, Frederica and Anders. They're both students and have recently paid $500 each to go to Noma, living off of kale and canned tuna for the rest of the month.
I don't feel elitist at all. I think it's something worth prioritizing.
Well, this was on top of my bucket list, so I'm not one of those, you know, just go there for, you know, the check-in on Facebook.
No. Frederica feels excited at Noma.
You just told me before that you were there together and they served you a potato that was 1 year old. And you liked it.
It wasn't my favorite dish, but I liked the texture. And I think maybe it's not just about the flavors, but also about the texture.
But yeah. So they got you to eat a really old potato.
They got us to eat ants as well. And grasshoppers.
What? I'm just taking this out of a limb. Like, what if they just served you a steaming pile of and said, this is from the cow that's just on the field outside this window. You can see it from here. Well,
I would probably say interesting texture.
I have been served ants, but they were dead on this occasion. It was for a dessert.
This is my friend and the biggest foodie I know, Kasper Mørk. He writes about restaurants for a city guide, and he absolutely loves Noma. He's been there a couple of times.
It was a blackberry sorbet with some toast, and then they had made a little cream or some mashed ants that was in there, and ants are very acidic. It was actually really, really nice with this very fruity, sweet ice cream. I don't think they just do something to get a reaction. I think they do it because they believe it tastes good. I remember when we went the first time, we had a snack, which has also sparked quite an interest in the media, which are live shrimps. You get them served in this little jar full of ice, and they're slightly sedated because it's so cold in the jar, but once you pick them up, they start like swirling and they want to get out of your fingers. And my sister dropped one and it sort of like ran across the table. And she was like, I cannot do this. And one of the other guests sort of caught it in the middle of the table and dipped it in some brown butter and threw it in his mouth.
To me, this sounds like a serious case of the Emperor's New Clothes. But does that even really matter? Here's my friend Anas again.
You are inclined, because of how it's delivered, to be very susceptible to various kinds of sort of weird stuff. You know, it's hard to maintain your sense of criticism. As long as you go out believing that you had a good experience, then maybe it's not that relevant whether it was actually a good experience.
Maybe it is like art. Maybe it's you aren't supposed to understand it. Maybe it's just there to widen your perspective. I don't think that this is for everybody. I think that a lot of people would go there and sit through 24 courses and be like, what the hell did I just eat?
I have to say, by now, I kind of want to go to Noma. If nothing else, then at least to be able to say that I hated it. For Good Food, I'm Christine Runo.
If Christine does decide to go to Noma, she's going to have to wait until March, because for most of January and February, the restaurant has relocated to Tokyo. Noma Japan is a 5-week pop-up during which Chef Rene Redzepi moved his entire restaurant, the decor, the chefs, the servers, even the dishwasher, to the Mandarin Oriental Hotel in Tokyo. 58,000 people tried to get a reservation, but guess who scored a table? Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, joins us now with his impressions from Noma Japan.
I think they were expecting to have it be mostly Tokyo people that went, because there's a lot of Japanese people that go to the Copenhagen restaurant. But apparently it's only about half Japanese that are there, and people are coming in from all over the world.
I can't imagine that really surprised him. What was it about Tokyo in particular that made him want to do this?
Well, Japan, or traditional Japanese cooking, has a lot of reverence for the land and the sea, a lot of use on extremely local, extremely seasonal products. And that is not dissimilar from the way he works. And I know, like, when he started Instagramming stuff a couple weeks before I went, you know, I'd look at the dishes and he'd be curing something on 2-year-old kombu. And the equivalent in Denmark would have been thrilling. Wow. But in Japan, everybody cures stuff on 2-year-old kombu, right? I mean, there are sushi bars in Los Angeles that do that.
So before you went, I remember talking to you and you were kind of perplexed about how he was going to do something that stood out from what a lot of super high-end chefs in Tokyo are already doing.
This was distinctly a Noma meal. And it was distinctly a Japanese meal, but it wasn't Japanese. And it was Nordic, but it wasn't Nordic. And I suppose the genius of what Redzepi does is able to work with different sets of ingredients places.
Okay, so take us through the meal.
There's a lot of different parts of it, but the first thing, you know, you sit down, you relax, you have a glass of champagne. They bring out this interesting plate that's like sort of circled with clams as decoration, and in the middle of it is a prawn, a single prawn. The head and the pincers and the legs is still intact, but the rest of the prawn has been completely denuded of its shell.
The prawn is alive.
The prawn is alive. And I've got to say, this isn't the first time I've seen anything like this. I mean, it's a way of serving in Korean restaurants. And it actually kicked when I put it in my mouth, which I hadn't expected at all. It was sort of freaky. And I should probably add that the live prawn was garnished with dead ants from the Nagano forest.
So it sounds like the first course is sort of a musing on life and death.
It could be. I mean, a lot of chefs, or at least chefs at the very highest level, sometimes make dishes that are made to be talked about as much as they are to be eaten. And I've actually never quite thought that he was one of those chefs. I mean, even somebody whose food I adore, like Alain Passard, will sometimes make weird juxtapositions on a plate that you think are weird at the time, but you realize that you remember them 6 months later. This one, nothing actually seemed weird on a plate. Though I suppose if you think about ants, maybe it would be a little bit weird. The next course was citrus segments, different kinds of citrus. There were herbs and there were little bits of pepper. But perhaps the thing that was the oddest about the dish was it was in a little puddle of oil that's been made by, marinating kombu seaweed. And he was saying that it sort of freaked Japanese people out a little bit because they'd never heard of it in oil. They've always thought of it in terms of water. So to have somebody make this sort of forest green extraction out of something that they think of as sort of pure and limpid in a watery medium was kind of great. It was a way of like sort of, you know, juxtaposing things. I'm not sure that he thought the reaction of locals would be so severe to that. Not necessarily that they didn't like it, but they were just so
shocked.
Yeah. I mean, if some chef came to the United States and started to boil bacon, I mean, we might think that was weird.
I don't know if it's a certain amount of hubris or a certain amount of excitement of doing what he's doing in the midst of a highly traditional culture.
Right. And I'm sure that most of the Japanese who went there were expecting to get like a Nordic meal. I'm not sure they were expected to have their own ingredients handed back to them quite that way. There was a course of cuttlefish that had been cut into something that looked like soba noodles, which is something you see a lot at izakaya, and it's not unknown as a sushi bar technique. And he took this cuttlefish, which had been live that morning, painted it with fermented cuttlefish guts that had been aging apparently in like a sub-basement of the hotel for 6 months, and had that, you know, wonderful salty fishy putrescence. That was laid on a traditional Japanese bamboo mat, and then there was like a little bowl of broth that had been made by like steeping conifers that was topped with an inch of fresh pink rose petals.
Wow.
And there's this contrast of, you know, the putrescent stink of the rotted fish guts and the sort of perfumey stink of the fresh blossoms. And it really is almost like a contrast. Okay, which one of these stinks? Which one is a foul smell? Are any of them a foul smell? Are both of them a foul smell? Do these go together in any particular way? And when you're done, you drink the piney broth, which has been, you know, sort of imbued with the umami from the squid guts. And it's a fascinating dish.
Were there any courses where you sort of lost your intellect and just became submerged in the pleasure?
I don't think it was that kind of thing, though you could have. It's just you're sort of your senses are heightened in a certain way. You know, some of the other things that were interesting were a tart that was made on a really crisp crust that was basically seaweed enhanced with – ground seaweed enhanced with a little bit of flour. And on it were clams, these tiny freshwater clams from a lake in the north of Honshu, 50 of them to a slice. Apparently, they shucked them all freaking day. I mean – that it takes the entire staff 2 or 3 hours every morning just to shuck the clams for the tart.
I saw a picture of this. It looks like a slice of pie.
Yeah, it looks a lot like a slice of pie. The reaction from Japanese is also interesting on this because these clams are never eaten.
Period?
Well, they're used for miso soup. So if you get miso soup, you put a handful of these clams in it and they'll flavor it. But the meat is so small that nobody's going to bother shucking it. You know, I was talking to a woman who was actually insulted that she'd been served this tart with the clams when some other people in the party, her party, had been served the tart with uni. And she thought the people with the uni were being VIP. But
in fact, she was the VIP.
She was the VIP.
Cultural context is everything.
It's so, so everything.
How many courses were there?
There were 16 courses in all.
So your takeaway from this experience?
Sometimes it's worth flying to Japan for dinner. The next time I do it, though, I think I'll eat Japanese food.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about his experience at NoMa Japan. You can hear the uncut interview on our blog. In case you haven't heard, Jonathan is the subject of a documentary, City of Gold, that debuts this week at Sundance. We'll talk about the making of the film next week with both Jonathan and the director, Laura Gabbert. But until then, we're going to stick with the Scandinavian theme. If you think ants and live shrimp are weird, just wait for what comes next. We'll get a taste of Iceland real soon.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. As I look at the new Nordic cuisine, it seems to be informed as much by local ingredients as it is by ideas. Sure, the chefs want to serve you delicious food, but they also want to feed your mind. Christian Pugliese left NoMa after 2 years as a sous chef to create his own venue to explore ideas. He has several restaurants in Copenhagen, including Relay, a book of the same name came out last year. Hi, Christian.
Hi.
You spend quite a bit of time at the beginning of the book talking about what you didn't want for your first personal venture, especially when, as it regards the service, which I find really interesting since I'm here in L.A., living in a city that has had an anti-fine dining culture for years.
Mm.
So talk to us a little bit about what you didn't want in the dining room for service.
Well, as I always keep comparing our initial approach to the restaurant as like our moment of being teenagers, there was many things we didn't want to do. That was very much the baseline, and we came from years at NoMa and years in other established fine dining restaurants, and for me it was obvious that what I wanted was to still cook at an ambitious level and still try and develop dishes, work creatively, work with the best produce. But there was sort of this other side of it, being the front of house, that I maybe, as many of my colleagues, maybe have been taking a bit for granted for many years. And I decided that I wanted to have my own touch on that and sort of be able to shape it in a way that made more sense for me personally and could feel more comfortable as an environment for me to be in daily.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I read a piece that you wrote about fine dining for your Tumblr, talking about asking the question if it's antiquated, actually. And you talk about how, for you, creating a space that would feel great for you and your staff to be in all day was the most important thing. So was the diner in that planning at all, or was it you as a diner or you as a chef?
Yeah, well, I think that's really the breaking point. That's where something starts to change, is when the people that cook the food also are able to go out and eat the food. As in, I have a kitchen now full of staff that enjoy going out to eat. I mean, maybe not many years ago, you as a chef, maybe you would not be able to eat in the type of restaurant, or as a cook at least, that you would work in, because you just simply wouldn't afford it. So something changes in the moment that you not only consider what you put on the plate, but also consider how people experience the food you cook when they eat at the restaurant. And for you to have any considerations about that, you need to obviously live the restaurant as well and be able to sit down in it. And that's my approach, was that I wanted to create a space where it would feel comfortable for me to be in, both working, but also if I would eat in the restaurant, I wanted it to be an experience that I would enjoy.
So tell us about that in a little more detail. For example, is there wine service? Do people pour wine? Are there servers? Who's bringing the plates out?
Well, we really try to cut everything to the bone. So to understand the physical shape of the restaurant, it is a small restaurant. It is a completely open kitchen that you can see as the first thing as you enter into the room. And it does give us the advantage of us being able to, from the kitchen and me from the pass, to overview the whole restaurant and see what's going on at all the tables. So we try to cut the more technical part of the service down to a minimum, because I thought that also I am based in Copenhagen, where the average wage is very high. So to give people value for money, you need to lose as little time as possible, because the more people you just have not doing much, the more people will pay for not really getting anything out of it. So the chefs serve basically all the food. It's more the waiters helping out if we are a bit behind, rather than the other way around. But for us, it's a very big deal, and it's a very easy way for us to also understand the table. We try and train all our cooks also to understand what's going on at the table, as in that table needs more wine, or they don't have the bottle of water is empty. But we leave the things as pouring the water. Like for me, pouring the water is the best example of what fine dining is, and what doesn't really make sense to me, because pouring me a glass of water is not doing anything to me. It's like, if I have water accessible, I can pour it myself. The important part is to have the water at the table. It's not to someone be at your side and pouring it. And actually, it can almost interrupt you so many times during a night that it's almost not a service. It's almost annoying, you know?
I really love it, because it sort of makes the diner and the kitchen on an equal playing field. There's the assumption that we're both adults.
Yeah.
We both know what we're going to do here. I'm going to eat, you're going to cook, and we're going to come together in a really low-maintenance kind of way.
Exactly. I think our generation, when you go out to eat some food, you go out to get some experience, try some foods you haven't tried before, to eat something delicious. It's not to be catered to in that butler kind of way. It's not to feel a service, outstanding service, that as soon as I get up, someone is pulling out my chair. Like, okay, good, but it's not saving my day in the way that the food can. But this doesn't mean that I don't think that good service should be there. For me, great service is empathy. Like, you understand, you try and put yourself in the shoes of a person walking into your restaurant. You can have so many people hire to wipe the tables or renew water or walk with the bread, but that doesn't mean that there's more people smiling at who's coming in the door.
Okay, so you had this experience of working where you worked before, and then immediately before you opened your own places at Noma for a few years. So when you were getting ready in your own mind to leave Noma, what were the dishes that you just wanted to bust out of that mold and do yourself? What was it that you wanted to bring into your food that you felt constrained working at Noma?
My idea was to say, okay, I want to have I want to cook food in a more humble frame, a bit more humble premise where the prices would be lower, so I would have some limitations on the food I can do. It cannot be as complicated as the things we do here. But also what I really enjoyed at Noma was that you could see some dishes where the thought process behind it would be where all the quality was, and the actual execution would actually be quite simple. So that would be dishes rich in ideas and in thoughts, and where the creative part of it would be in the before you execute the dish.
You have olive oil on the tables.
Definitely.
So do you consider yourself a part of what is called the new Nordic cuisine?
No, not at all. I think with time I realized that the only dogma that really stands time is the dogma of just cooking quality. I never felt a part of a new Nordic movement. I am an immigrant myself. I'm born in Sicily, and I came here with, Copenhagen with my parents at a young age. My mother's Norwegian. I've worked in France. I've worked in Spain. I'm in the States right now. I feel like to constrain gastronomy with geography is very wrong. Like, I'm totally about using local ingredients as much as possible for many obvious reasons. But as a cultural approach, for me not to use produce and things that are part of where I come from, as the olive oil, anchovy, olives and citrix and these things, would not make very much sense.
This has been such an immense pleasure talking to you, Christian. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking the time.
That was Christian Pugliese. His restaurants in Copenhagen are Relay, Manfred's, and Beast. His new book is titled Relay, A Book of Ideas. My generation of chefs were in some ways food-based social anthropologists. We traveled, and we wanted to recreate the food we fell in love with through travel. But for today's young chefs, the lens is more complex. Both the operations of the restaurant and the food is much more personal. This is true of Los Angeles chef Ari Taymor, chef owner of Alma. Hi, Ari.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so great to have you here. Was there a particular moment that you knew you wanted to cook?
Yeah, I was eating a tasting menu at Ubuntu when Jeremy Fox was still the chef there. And I had started dabbling in cooking at that point, but I didn't really know if this was something that I wanted to do. And I sat there and I was having his 6-course, mostly vegan, vegetable-based tasting menu. And I had never had anything like it, and it blew me away. And it was so personal, and I felt so connected, and it looked so foreign, and I was just completely taken aback by everything, that I knew that it was something that I wanted to be a part of.
So after you had that Ubuntu experience, did you decide that you wanted to stage some more?
Yeah, I took an externship with Suzanne Goen, actually, at Luke at that point. I had seen a Craigslist ad for her looking for a line cook, so I just sent an email, and she responded saying that she doesn't, you know, hire kids as green as I was straight off the bat, but if I wanted to come down for an externship, she would be happy to have me. So I went down there and was promptly blasted out of that kitchen.
Why?
I wasn't about the lifestyle. It's really, to be a cook, you have to be committed to ideals beyond yourself. And I was a selfish, spoiled, middle-class kid from the Bay Area, and I wasn't prepared really for what that work ethic was like. And so I was, you know, asking if I could go home. I was, you know, not really about the cleaning. It was just all the things now that that get me so upset as a chef when you see young cooks. I was that. And so she correctly sent me packing.
So after you got blown out of that kitchen, how did you lick your wounds?
I went to Berkeley and I got another internship at a place called Three Stone Hearth, which was a community-supported kitchen. It's basically like a CSA, but for prepared food. So they buy everything from local farms. All their meat is pasture-raised. They do a ton of fermenting. And twice a week, they do these sales out of their warehouse where people come and pick up and they do deliveries. And the food is nutrient dense and it's meant to be wholesome, healthy food. So I spent about 6 months just cooking there at a really slow pace and really just feeling out, you know, being on your feet for that many hours a day and the hygienic standards that cooking requires. And that was really when I started to fall in love with the day-to-day of cooking.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I came to it from a place where I already was sort of obsessed with handwork and knowing that I wanted to be really physical.
For me, I entered into cooking more for political reasons. I was studying public health, and I was studying human anthropology and international affairs in college. And the more I started to delve into just the disparity between diabetes rates in low-income communities and that in the rest of affluent America, I was just started to become horrified that this was a human rights issue that was going on, that people were being denied access to healthy, nutritious food. And I saw that chefs were the ones who didn't feel like they had to be politically correct. And, you know, Suzanne Gowen in particular was extremely outspoken about farmers markets and local food. And I felt like that was who I wanted to be around, were the people at the tip of the spear who didn't care about ruffling feathers.
So you're at this community kitchen and then you decide to make another move.
Yeah, I went to this place, Lalim, in Berkeley, which is like a really quaint, wonderful neighborhood restaurant. And then when the economy fell out, the business there went completely downhill, and I left and went to help open Flower and Water.
Flower and Water, the restaurant in San Francisco. So when do you finally go to Europe?
It was after. I spent about a year and a half at Flower and Water. I was, you know, at first I was horrified by how hard I was working, and then I just, like, something clicked and I fell in love. And after my year and a half, I knew that I wanted to go to Europe, and I knew that I wanted to go to France in particular. And I saw a PBS interview with this chef, Armand Arnal, who is the chef at La Chassagnette, which is a small one-star Michelin in Arles. And what differentiates that place from any other restaurant in Europe that I've ever seen is that it's certified organic, and they have their own farm, and they do everything from growing and, like, creating their own heirloom red rice to growing olives and pressing their olive oil. And they're only open when they can supply the restaurant 100% with produce from their own garden. And 6 months before I wanted to go, I started calling and leaving messages on the reservation line and emailing whatever public email address they could have. And I did that like 3 times a week for about 3 months before I heard back from them. And finally, I think they got tired of hearing broken French on their message machine. And the chef reached out to me and said I could come.
When were you able to start making the food in the style that you fell in love with when you were staging at La Chassagnette?
I think fairly recently, as maybe even 5 or 6 months ago, is the first time I feel like I've been able to execute the food that exists in my mind.
And what came together to allow that to finally happen?
I think an evaporation of my ego to a degree, and just this desire to control and manipulate vanished. And I just was left inspired by the produce and just emotional connections that I'd had throughout the course of my life. And I found that those were the important things that I wanted to portray about the restaurant and the cooking and what was going on, and not so much wowing people with my technique or showing something that they'd never seen before or confronting people with different flavors. It just became a gentler approach to the food.
When I came in and ate at Alma, one of the things that really struck me is your palate. Your palate is so unusual for this city, a place that just reveres the flavor bomb. Your food is very dialed back. I would say delicate. Some say austere. And it's obviously a very, very conscious choice.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, I think that cooking for a lot of people is about a connection and an emotional connection to something in their past, whether it's a trip like you were talking about or a family member or something. For me, those emotional connections happened outside when I was a kid and I was at summer camp in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and I would have these sense memories of different smells or the way the fog breaks in that part of the Central Coast in the summertime and the sun hits the ground and everything just explodes. And those were the moments when I was an adolescent where I was feeling all the crazy things that kids feel. And so it's about nature and it's about product kind of in its rawest, truest state. And so to do that, it really requires stepping back and listening and focusing and tasting on how things taste naturally and, you know, doing everything we can to support that. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's, you know, labor-free raw vegetables. It just means that you hide your techniques and you hide your seasoning. And so when you taste a turnip or when you taste a carrot, it just tastes like what it is.
Ari, what a treat to just be able to sit down and have this conversation. Thank you.
It was such a pleasure. We're all big fans of you, so it was really an honor to be here.
Ari Tamor is chef owner of Alma in downtown L.A. Coming up, we're going way north, first to Iceland, then to the Arctic Circle. Stay with us.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
Many of us long for winter, but have to content ourselves with 63-degree sweater weather. So hearing about real winters in extreme northern climes can be a fantastic vicarious thrill. Take reindeers, for example. When we think of reindeers, there are Christmas friends pulling Santa's sleigh. But it's not so for the Sami people. They live at the highest point of the European map, far above the Arctic Circle. And for them, reindeer aren't a seasonal construct. They're an everyday part of life. French photographer Céline Clanet originally traveled to the region as a tourist. She's returned in subsequent years to document the area and its people. Her images can be found in her book of photographs named after their small village, Mazé. Hi, Céline.
Hi.
So you have focused your relationship with the people in northern Norway, but the Sami people actually have a larger range than that, don't they?
Yeah, of course. It's actually a symbolic area. It has no border, but Lapland spreads over the four countries of Northern Europe. So Norway, Sweden, Finland, and northwestern Russia.
But Northern Norway has the majority of the population of Sami right now.
Yes, almost half of it.
Describe them. Are they considered to be an indigenous people?
They are, actually. They are the only indigenous people of Europe. They were the first inhabitants of Europe, and you can find traces of them 10,000 years ago.
So what is their relationship with the reindeer?
Well, reindeer is the heart of the Sami culture today. But you have to know that it's a minority of Sami people that are reindeer herders. It's like in Norway, for instance, it's 10% of the Sami population that it's still related to reindeer herding. So reindeer herders among Sami are a minority, actually. But in Norway, it's a very strong culture.
And historically, what did the animals supply for them? Was it for food, for clothing, for heat?
Yes, first, we're talking 1,000 years ago, they were hunting them and they were following them to hunt them and kill them. And of course, just for eating. And since the 15th century, 16th century, they started to herd them and to follow special herds in the tundra. And so nowadays, they are herders, but they are breeding wild animals. So that means that people live in houses. For instance, a herder has his family in the houses, but he spends weeks and days in the tundra with the animals, managing them, and especially during migrations of the animals, they have to follow them all the time during migration.
And this process of herding is kind of unusual up there because the landscape is broken up between tundra and water. You've actually photographed them being loaded onto a boat. So do people actually have to help them achieve their migration?
Yeah, exactly. Not all of them, because some herds have their summer pastures inland, but some herds have their summer pastures on an island. And so to avoid many losses due to drowning, Some herders hire big boats where they load the herd inside and then cross the sea and go to the island for the whole summer.
So how many reindeer approximately are in this area?
Well, in Mardsi area, it's difficult to say, but I know that in northern Norway, it's over 1,000. It's almost 2,000 reindeer. Actually, too many reindeer for the land right now.
So are they harvested and sold as meat to more urban-dwelling Sami?
It's for everyone, actually, because Sami do eat a lot of reindeer meat, but it's also for the rest of Norway and actually the rest of Europe also.
How is it usually served? Is it dried or smoked?
Well, many ways. Actually, there's a difference of eating between Sami people and the rest of Europe, I think. For instance, Sami people do eat a lot of dry reindeer meat on a daily basis. Whether if you go to southern Scandinavia, you will have it fried or roasted reindeer, actually.
Thank you so much, Celine. It's been really lovely talking with you.
Thank you.
That was French photographer Celine Clenet. She's been traveling to the far north of Norway for years to document the Sami reindeer herders of the region. Her photographs immediately sucked us into their unique way of life. You can see a few of them on the Good Food blog. Across the Atlantic and Iceland, the extreme climate and topography has informed a very specific Nordic cuisine. At his restaurant Dill in Reykjavik, chef Gunnar Karl Gislason embraces these extremes, using his rugged country as his muse. His new book, which he co-authored with Jody Eddy, is called North. Hi, Gunnar.
Hi.
So a visitor comes to Dill. What plates do you put in front of them that reveals your personal vision of Nordic cuisine?
We focus so much on those ingredients that we have all around us. Even more importantly, we focus on the old traditions. Dried fish, some dirt-smoked either fish or lamb. Definitely, we would be doing some preserving methods at some point, especially if you're coming during the winter time, you would probably have a lot of them. So it's a lot of things.
So let's talk about that dried fish, because when I was in Iceland, I don't think I ever experienced sitting down at a table and having, instead of bread being brought to me, having dried fish and butter being brought to me, and then being told to butter the fish and eat it like bread.
Yeah, exactly. Nowadays, we probably don't eat as much as we used to, but still we eat a lot of it. And usually it's eaten more like snack now, I guess. People just rip the meat out of from the skin and eat it with butter.
It's delicious, actually.
It's really good, yeah. It's really good. There's many different ways to do it, and we have a lot of like new producers now that are like they're making nice dried fish, and there's nothing wrong with using new methods. But at the restaurant at Dill, we focus only on the old traditions. So it's some now people are drying it in special ovens or dehydrators, something like that. But the ones that we use is only the one that is dried outside. They're only able to do it during the winter time, so it's the temperature has to be below zero. It's only dried like really close to the ocean, so it gets all the flavors from the sea, and it's just an unbelievable flavors that you get from it.
What types of fish are used for that drying?
Mainly, it's haddock and catfish.
Is the reason that there is this old tradition of eating dried fish that there wasn't a big grain tradition in Iceland, so bread was not as easily available?
No, I mean, at some points probably it was available, because back in the days, I mean, in Iceland, people have been growing grains and barley and stuff like that since the time of Vikings. But still, if you had cold winters or summers, they wouldn't have that much. So I think definitely because of lack of grains, but probably even more because as a preserving method. So you would go and fish and you would have to preserve that fish somehow. And they would do it like this.
Is there a really long tradition of using seaweeds in Iceland?
Yeah, I mean, in the old books, you can read a lot about the black salt. And then they were actually making salt out of seaweed. They would actually just take seaweed and burn it over open fire and grain it and use it instead of salt.
Wow. How do you use seaweed?
Well, for an example, we definitely make black salt like they did in the time of Vikings. We will dry it, powder it, and use it to season things. We will cook it and pickle it and etc. It's like you can use it for so many things. It's amazing.
I have to say that when I visited Iceland, one of the signature flavors that I experienced was this very unusual smoked flavor, which I understand is called dirt smoking.
Yeah. In Iceland, we didn't have so many trees. Or, I mean, maybe the Vikings just burned them all to heat their houses or something. But at least there was a lack of trees. So they actually had to find something else to burn and something else to smoke with and etc. And so they started to use lamb dirt, actually. So while the lambs are in the houses during the winter time, they will do, you know, like number one and two on the floor. And they will bring some hay in it as well, and they will walk on it the whole winter. And when the winter is over, all the sheep go up to the mountains where they pretty much live freely the whole summer. The farmer will go into the those houses, and he will cut down the dirt from the floor into layers, dry them for at least half a year or something, before he can actually start using it to smoke with. And then he has to carefully select the right dirt, because it cannot be too wet or too dry. If it's too wet, it won't burn. If it's too dry, it will just go up in flames. So he has to find the right texture so he can put a fire on it without it going up in flames. And then he has the perfect dirt to smoke with.
And what is the what are the products that are most commonly smoked in this way?
Mostly it's char, like a char or trout. And then like during Christmas time, it's everybody will eat something called hankikjöt, which is a smoked leg of lamb.
I would love for you to talk about another ingredient that I've never heard of before, and that's the seabird eggs.
Oh yeah, well they have this amazing color and amazing like spots on it, and they are actually oval, because the birds, they lay their eggs in the cliffs. So the eggs are oval, so they actually don't just roll off the cliffs and down to the sea. The flavors are just much, much more intense. And I believe, like, if you imagine everything that an egg should have, a seabird egg will have, like, two times more at least.
How do you use them?
Usually I try to serve them like as plain as possible. So usually we just serve them cooked, and then we just try to cut them nicely into, I mean, depending on the eggs, but they're usually quite big, so we just try to cut them maybe in four pieces and just serve them with little flakes of salt on the top of it, maybe a emulsion of burned butter and a little herb oil or something, and that's it. Like, try to do something very simple, very plain, so the guests can experience the flavors of the egg.
Gunnar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us from so far away.
It was a pleasure.
Gunnar Carl Gislason is chef owner at Dill in Reykjavik. His new book is North, the New Northern Cuisine of Iceland. Coming up, I'm not sure if cherimoyas are any less exotic than ants or reindeer meat, but they do grow a little closer to home. We'll be right back with the Market Report next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food. It's time for the Market Report with Laura Avery. Let's check in with her to find out what's fresh and in season this week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting today with Nick Brown, and he and his sister, Christine, represent Rincon del Mar Ranch. Their father, Tony Brown, bought this beautiful, beautiful hillside piece of property, and he planted a lot of cherimoyas. And Nick and Christine are now bringing these beautiful fruit to the Wednesday Santa Monica Market. So, Nick, describe to us the cherimoya, what it's like, what your program is like, what your season is, and try to make us visualize these beautiful fruit.
It's like a tropical fusion of mango, pineapple, banana, a little bit of vanilla custard. It's just everything. I could go on for days, but it's sweet, juicy, creamy. It's ice cream and a fruit. And we've been growing new varieties, trying to find the best thing for our climate, our spot, and we educate people so they know exactly what they're getting, and they tell their friends, they tell their family, and cherimoyas it's just blossoming into this awesome thing, and we're happy to be a part of it, keep the family legacy going.
Let's try to describe this. Now, when I met your dad and you guys, you were visiting, and you had a bag with cherimoyas in it, and they were the size of a small bowling ball, and I looked and I said, where'd you get those? Because cherimoyas we had been much smaller, and when you said you grew them, I sort of invited you on the spot.
Absolutely, yeah. We get a lot of people that think that they look like an artichoke. I personally think they look like dragon eggs, and some of them really are small bowling balls. It ranges. No two cherimoyas look the same. You can have the small little itty-bitty ones. You can have the ones that are 3 pounds. And we get those giant ones by hand-pollinating the fruit, and that's something that we're not exclusively doing, but we are definitely pioneers about it, just because it helps ensure a more uniform sized fruit. You get the most amount of flesh around each seed, but the cherimoyas look like a green, lime green, scaly ostrich egg kind of thing. And some look like hearts, some look like ovals. They've got a white, creamy flesh inside, big black seeds. They're really striking fruit to look at.
And your dad enjoyed them with a squeeze of a tangerine, because they are sometimes so sweet that little tiny bit, not a sour citrus, not a lemon, but that tangerine just pulls it all together. It is so delicious eaten that way.
Absolutely, yeah. That's actually what the Spaniards prefer to do, is they slice open the cherimoya and they put a tangerine, a mandarin, just any kind of sweet citrus. And it brings on a whole slew of other tropical flavors that I could, again, list for days. But it's another nice way to enjoy the fruit.
And Nick, how much longer will the season go on?
This year, the season started about a month earlier than we've ever had because of the weather last year. But we're looking at another 2 months of cherimoyas, hopefully.
Okay, well, that's great. And working your way through the various varieties, I recommend that people try one of each variety. Nick and Christine will tell you which are which, and just enjoy them while they're here. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you. See you soon.
See you here. That was Nick Brown. He and his sister Christine and their dad Tony are the cherimoya growers from Rincon del Mar, and they'll be at the Wednesday Market for about 2 more months. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery. One of the best ways to enjoy cherimoyas is to walk up to a chef and ask him what to do. And we're lucky that we have right here Josiah Citron, who is the chef of the 2-Michelin-star Melis restaurant right here in Santa Monica, just a few blocks from the market. Josiah, you're doing something with cherimoyas. Now tell us what the dish is.
Yeah, we love the cherimoyas. So what we're doing with the cherimoyas is we do an almond milk granita. with tangerine jelly and tangerine sorbet.
And a granita is a shaved ice?
Yes, it's a shaved ice. Uh-huh. So basically we use almond milk and put a little sugar in it, and then we shave it, you know, freeze it and shave the ice. It's real fluffy with that texture of the cherimoya and that little hint of the citrus with it, the tangerine. It's just an amazing flavor.
How do you prepare the cherimoya? Because they're really kind of a mess.
Well, basically what we do is we have to buy them, and then we let them ripen and right to the right point, and then we just cut them in wedges, and then we use the tweezers and pick out the little black. It kind of looks like Swiss cheese, right?
Yeah. Big black shiny seeds.
Yeah.
Now, when you say you let them get just right, there is that moment when they are perfect, and they actually are not too soft.
Yeah, it's just like one moment. You have like, it's basically like a, like once they hit the right point, it's like 2 to 3 days that they're perfectly ready to eat, and then it can go kind of softer and go beyond that. And then you could take it, take out the seeds and, you know, make a puree in and turn it into sorbet or something. It's really got a great texture mm-hmm. for making sorbets.
But the way the cherimoya is served on top of the granita, is it just in its just fresh state?
Yeah, it's just a wedge. So basically it's a wedge. It's the tangerine jelly in the bottom, the granita, and then the wedge of the cherimoya, and then the tangerine sorbet. It's very simple. We really don't want to play with that texture, and that it's just such an amazing texture that the fruit has. Kind of want the customers and the guests experience in that sense, because I don't think it's something that very many people have tried.
All right. Well, this sounds like a wonderful thing to try. Thanks so much for the recipe.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
That was Josiah Citron. He is the chef owner at the 2-Michelin-star Melisse restaurant, which is right around the corner from the Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Follow us on Instagram so you can see what's in season every week at your local farmers market. Find us at KCRW Good Food. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen whenever you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thank you so much to the Good Food team, Jillian Larrell, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan Kleiman. Find me here next week for another edition of Good Food.